knees, and barely kept him from the cold hardness of the stone floor. He'd fought the slave traders. When the auctioneer had brought his gavel down and announced the sale of Deimos's flesh and bone, he had roared and lunged while they dragged him away. They had sold him dearly, his heritage and name making him perhaps the most desirable trophy slaves sold in that square for many years. He still did not know what had become of his mother and brother. Three quiet men had thundered their fists down upon him, rained kicks at his back and skull, and chained him into the back of a closed wagon. When they had reached their destination and they had pressed the white-hot brand to his flesh, he'd struggled so much that they had beaten him unconscious. And when he woke inside this cell, he had no idea where in the city he might be, if he was even in the city. Questions had raced through his head. Where was he? What noble had purchased him? Who would stoop so low as to prey on the misery of a once proud family? The lock tumbled with a clank, and he wondered if some answers might finally be coming. Deimos sniffed, tightening his fists, and glared at the door. One of his eyes had swollen mostly shut, and he still ached from the beating he'd taken. He was weak, too, from the meager food and water he was occasionally granted. Yet if an opportunity presented itself, he would fight. To do otherwise would be to betray his mother and brother, whom he was desperate to find. The door scraped across the floor as it opened. Deimos's one good eye went wide, and for a brief moment he could only stare at the ice-blue gaze of the woman who stood in the doorway. There was no sign of the three gray-garbed brutes who'd been there every other time the door had opened. Only this woman, with her hair like dirty wheat and those winter eyes. Deimos had encountered pirates and wandered the shores of distant islands. He'd beaten penters for information, and he'd breathed the same air as men dying of disease. But as quickly as the shock hit him, now his nose wrinkled, the muscles in his neck tightened, and he averted his gaze from this woman he had been raised not to see. Bajuman. His fists opened. He would not fight her.
"Good morning, slave," the Bajuman said. "I am Mouse."
Deimos stared into a corner of the tiny cell. Black mold grew on the wall. The mortar between stones sweated with moisture, and the blocks themselves were rimmed with the yellow accumulation of decades of spiza smoke. A slave he might now be, branded forever. But he had been taught to never acknowledge a Bajuman. She apparently had no compunction about acknowledging him. Moving so swiftly he did not have time even to blink, she caught him with a single blow to his face before grabbing him by the hair and the wrist as she drove him against the wall. All hesitation gone, Deimos bucked against her, striking out with his free hand. But she just bounced his head off the wall again. With a snicker, she reached down and took his balls in her grasp, squeezing enough to make him freeze in place, as if time itself had halted.
"I don't want to waste time playing with you, Deimos," she said. "Look at me."
He averted his eyes once more. Her grip tightened. He allowed a groan to escape his lips, but it wasn't the pain that made him finally turn to see her. It was the familiarity in her voice, as if she knew him.
"My face, slave. Look at my face."
Deimos shivered in pain, inhaled sharply, and finally met her wintry gaze. Mouse released her grip and stepped back, wiping her hand on her trousers.
"There. Was that so difficult?"
Confused, he began to look away, but she clucked her tongue and he focused on her again, hating his obedience. Something about the curve of her jaw, the shape of her shoulders, and the ridge of her nose.
"There it is," she whispered. "Recognition."
How could it be? He wondered. All his life he'd been taught that Bajuman were untouchable, invisible, beneath the lowest born.
He was a reasonable man and had never found reason to hate them, but his gaze shifted away from them like rain running off a roof. This woman. "Hello, boy," she said. And the two words echoed down through his lifetime to childhood. They unlocked memories of laughter and hiding places in his family home, and blood in his mouth from the punishment his father would mete out every time he learned of his son playing with the thing in their darkest cellar, the child of the Bajaman who butchered the animals for their table. "Hello, boy." Deimos frowned. Somehow the pain of the past few days sank its claws deeper into him. "Hello, girl," he whispered, as he had when they were children. He frowned, not understanding so many things. Every instinct told him to turn away, but he kept his focus on those wintry eyes. I don't even know your name. He remembered the way they had once run from the cook when they'd been discovered hiding among meat hung to cure in the room behind the cellar chimney. Despite his pains and his loss, the memory softened Deimos, enough that the left side of his mouth edged up into the beginning of a smile. She struck him with such force that his head snapped backward and he crumpled to the floor. For unknown seconds, the world went black, and then vision and sound returned. He groaned and rolled onto his side, curling up. He had never been ashamed of his nakedness, but his balls remembered how willing she was to make use of their vulnerability, and he made to protect them. "Mouse," she said, crouched beside him. "I am called Mouse. It's the only name you need and more than you deserve. It's important for you to understand your position in the household, so let's begin there." Her voice hushed. "You are nothing, less than nothing, beneath Bajuman." "How can you be here?" he asked. Mouse cuffed his ear, hard enough to start it ringing, hard enough to draw a trickle of blood. But Deimos thought perhaps not quite as hard as she could have hit him. He wanted to think some lingering childhood fondness held her back, but his skull throbbed and warm blood slid along the curve of his chin. "For the same reason you're here," she said, and she hit him again, harder, no trace of sentiment there. "I am here because I'm a slave. Soldiers came and took the slaves from the Calistrate household, claimed us for the crown. And I promise you they did not treat us with the tenderness that I've shown you.
If you've tenderness to offer, perhaps you left it elsewhere," he suggested. "What I've seen thus far,"
she smacked him across the face, "is more kindness than you deserve." Mouse stood and he flinched, thinking she meant to kick him. "You'll stoke the fires and powder spices for the chimneys. You may be allowed to butcher an animal the way my father did if you prove adept at it. But you live in this cellar now. This room is your home." Deimos exhaled, taking that in. He had assumed it a holding cell, but this box had just become his world. Mouse moved to the door. She opened it, and the stink of piss wafted in again, with the aromas of spices smoke drifting in behind it. The combination made him want to retch, but his eyes were on that door. The three who had taken him, who had beaten him, were nowhere to be seen. She was strong and fast, and he at least temporarily weak and slow. But if he could make it past her. "You'll wash yourself every third day," she said, ghostly eyes shining in the shadows. "Twice a day you'll be fed whatever scraps the household has left behind. If our master has guests, you will often be hungry. But when her house is quiet, you may have enough to sate you. Do not meet the gaze of anyone other than another slave. And even then, I'd watch yourself. Do not speak to anyone other than another slave. Again, I'd suggest you keep most of your thoughts to yourself. Are these instructions understood?" Deimos swiped at the blood trickling from his ear.
"They are."
He did not stand. "Good,"
said Mouse. Remember them well. They are about to be tested. I'll take you to the slave's bath. You will wash quickly and dress in the tunic I provide, and then I will lead you through the kitchen and to the quarters of Vasto, the Praegis.
As you say, Deimos replied, mustering as much dignity as he could manage while still keeping his gaze mostly averted.
Each noble house had a Praegis, a slave who had risen over time to become the virtual head of the household, the only slave who had regular contact with his or her owners. Already he imagined himself supplanting the one called Vasto as Praegis. Existence as a sailor had scoured from his spirit most of the whimsy that life in the nobility had inspired. But Deimos had always been a pragmatist. He hoped that Mirren would be able to prevail upon the queen, to hold himself and his family innocent of whatever offense his father might have given, real or imagined. But until such time, he had to walk the path before him and find a way to thrive. Mouse eyed him up and down, then stepped into the corridor and gestured for him to follow. Though the stink of Spiza hung oppressively in the air, and though his new keeper had just outlined the constraints upon this new life, still he felt his spirits lift as he left the square box of his room behind. This meager dram of freedom would not quench his thirst for it, but it was refreshing.
Go on! Mouse pointed to the left.
Your bath awaits. The corner of her mouth lifted in rueful humor. How many times had she used those same words to one member of his family or another, but under vastly different circumstances? Deimos lowered his gaze to the floor.
May I ask one question?
He steeled himself, prepared for punishment, prepared to bleed again.
Carefully. She warned. You may.
Deimos glimpsed those winter eyes, but only for a moment.
If I'm to meet with the Praegis, is there anything else I must do to avoid angering him?
I'm taking you to the quarters of the Praegis, but it isn't Vasto you will meet there.
Mouse shoved him, and he caught himself on the wall as he staggered toward a set of stone stairs.
This one time, you'll meet your mistress.
Chapter 5. It wasn't the first Bodjumin mouth he'd had wrapped around his prick. It wasn't the 20th, nor the 50th. 100th? Perhaps. Prince Aris had lost count long ago, but that initial touch of moist mouth and warm tongue always felt like the first. He groaned and lay back on the heavily cushioned bed. The delicious flick of a tongue across his balls sent a shiver through his body. Then another, licking at the same time, and when he looked down he saw all three of them bent over him, one from the left, two from the right. They were naked, oiled, beautiful Bodjumin women, proud of their brands and relishing this moment of power he allowed them, sucking and fucking a prince. Being naked and unashamed before Quandian royalty. What they knew, and what he didn't mind them knowing at all, was that it also afforded him a deep sense of power. Free from the bindings of princehood, there was power in doing whatever he wished, whenever he desired. He would never love a Bodjumin, but neither could he bring himself to hate them. How could he? They were gorgeous, and they set him free. While the women to his left and right worked on his balls, the one suckling on his manhood lifted her legs across his body and presented herself to him. For the thousandth time, Prince Aris wondered whether a royal tongue lapping at them felt any different from a slave's or a fellow Bodjumin's, and for the thousandth time that thought lost itself in the delicious moment. Aris groaned and writhed, abandoning himself to wonderful sensation.
Good Zenapan wine warmed his stomach and freed his mind to concentrate on nothing but here and now. The spies of these three Bajuman women had ground, combined with oil, and spread on their bodies for him and each other to lick off, coursed through his veins, setting his senses alight and sparkling across his skin, heightening every sensation to almost unbearable extremes. Yet Aris bore it well. He always did. He closed his eyes and flowed with what made him feel most alive. The room was warm with body heat, and the flickering fire from the torches and sconces on the walls. The air hung heavy with the aromas of lovemaking, spiza, and spilled wine. The walls were splayed with Bajuman artwork, harshly carved figures performing arcane rituals. He knew that such expressions of their history and beliefs were banned, but few people ventured into Bajuman homes, and the practice was widespread. He sometimes wondered what these figures were doing, and why their representations were so basic and formless, almost as if the Bajuman chose to draw like children. But he did not wonder for long. In truth, he didn't care. He didn't come to places like this to admire their artwork. The woman squirming on top of him tensed and squealed, releasing him from her mouth as she found her own shuddering release. She moved aside, her sweat-slicked body slipping from the bed to lie on the rug-covered floor. Pushing himself up onto his elbows, he looked down at the two women still working on him. One was tall and thin, her piercing eyes closed, but in pleasure, not shame. He found no shame in these wonderful women. He treated them as equals, perhaps the most terrible, damning secret for a man who bore so many. And before and after their lovemaking, he would talk to them, honor them, and put their concerns at rest. He always did. He found a satisfaction in their gratitude and humility that was almost as great as... almost. "Carry on," he gasped. "I fear it's just the two of you now." The woman on the right grinned up at him. She was shorter and far more voluptuous, and it was she who opened her mouth and swallowed him down, never once losing eye contact. And such eyes, like winter aflame, their deep blue coolness caught the candles set around the room and scorched into his soul, setting fires deeper than any he had ever known from any woman other than a Bajuman. Aris did not fool himself. These women were no more skilled at sex than any other he could have chosen to sate his needs across the kingdom. But their unbridled joy at his acceptance of them gave them an almost animal passion, a primeval need to enjoy him as much as he enjoyed them. He had had two, many times before, but three, never. This was a first. When opportunity presented, he was not one to turn it aside. The fires were building, within him as well as deep in the Bajuman women's eyes. Wine soothed him, spiza tingled his senses, and he felt himself surging toward a release, the first of many. And if that meant he remained here a day and a night, then... The heavy curtain covering the door was swept aside. A draft of air flushed into the room, flickering the candles, a frigid jolt on sweat-soaked skin that sent sharp shadows jerking across the walls. The woman to his left sat up and turned toward the doorway, and... Aris could not understand quite what happened next. At the exact moment of his explosive release, the woman's head snapped back and her throat was open, blood splashing across his groin and stomach to merge with his seed, and his mind shrank back from the harsh truth of what was happening. The voluptuous woman to his right rolled onto her back, her legs and arms straightening upward as the figure thrust a heavy sword into her gut. She screamed. The woman on the floor stood, darting for the edge of the room, but was swiftly caught by a fist wrapped in her hair.
Shom, Aris thought, and against all possibilities he knew that he was right.
Shom, captain of the Silent, taller than most men and tattooed with promises of horror, pulled the woman back by her hair until she landed across Aris's blood-splashed legs. The first woman thrashed on the floor, bleeding out from her gashed throat. The woman to his right was spluttering, the sword now hacked upward into her rib cage. The woman pushed down across his legs, lashed out with her hands, and caught Shom across the face. Skin parted. Blood dripped.
No, Aris said, still not quite understanding. No, what is this? What's...
Shom looked down upon him with disgust. She let go of the sword and reached for the third woman with both hands, pushing her against Aris's thighs, pressing down and twisting until she snapped the Bajuman's neck. Aris felt the break transmitted through his legs. She was looking back and up at him when the fire went from her eyes, and they turned paler than ever before. Not pale. Dead.
No,
Aris said again. He made no effort to cover himself. He could not comprehend what was happening. Wine and spies emerged and confused. He was not a fighting man, and he carried no weapons. But he knew they would not have been any use. Not against Shom. She stood upright and stared down at him, blood dripping from her face. She took a long, frank look at him from head to toe, and Aris felt a sudden rush of rage. How dare she look at him like that? How dare she intrude upon a prince's private moment and... His cock was waning. Blood was already cooling across his body, even as the other two Bajuman women quivered their last. And then he knew how she would dare. She would dare because she had been sent with this task in mind.
My mother?
Aris asked.
Shom blinked. My sister.
Shom grabbed the sword and tugged it from the dead woman's body. It dripped. She raised it back over her left shoulder, tensed, determined, silent as ever. Her muscled arm shone in the candlelight. Her tattooed face and scalp told stories of agony and death. The killing blow would take only a moment. The seconds passed.
I am your prince, Aris whispered.
His voice was shaking and he hated that, but it could not be helped. He was not brave. There'd never been a reason for him to be. Shom tensed again, pulling the sword back a little more as she prepared to swing it down and onto his body. He could not bear to imagine the pain of metal cleaving flesh. The thought of his insides turned out, but he was so petrified that neither could he move. But for a few more seconds, nothing happened, and that emboldened him just a bit.
I am your prince!
He injected as much righteous anger into his voice as he could. Pleased that the shaking was gone, his tone lower and more commanding. And Shom gave pause once more. She frowned, glanced aside, and lowered her heavy sword. How many had it killed, Aris could not guess. Three more than yesterday, with the Bajuman women who lay dead about this room. But no more today, thank the gods. Shom placed the tip of her sword on the floor and rested her hands on its hilt. She was still frowning, turning over some inner conflict. Aris recognized the doubt in her eyes and he released a held breath he hadn't been aware of holding. He closed his eyes and prayed to the four for their kindness and mercy. Only to feel a large, calloused hand close around his cock and balls. And even as Aris's eyes snapped open again, and his mouth dropped wide to yell, The shout froze in his throat when Shom sliced her sword through his manhood's root. Aris had never known such pain, such shock. The scream might remain locked in forever. "Kill me," he wanted to shout. "Finish what you started." But Shom did not kill him, and that was somehow worse. She threw his severed genitals to the floor between the dead women and sheathed her sword, and Aris wondered if it was over. But then she drew her knife, and as he tried to scramble away, she slashed across his forehead and cheeks, his nose and lips, long, deep cuts that he knew were enough to scar him hideously. The pain was white hot and ice cold and warred with the agony between his legs. Then she grabbed him around one foot and dragged him from the bed. His head struck the floor, dazing him. For minutes or hours, Aris floated on planes of blinding agony. Light and dark played before his eyes. They merged and pulsed, each throb matching that of his hammering heart. As Shom dragged him, he felt carpets and rugs beneath him, then wood, then naked stone, and then the thump, thump of a long staircase leading down, down, down. Splinters dug into his back and thighs, and then stone abraded his skin. He heard only her steady footsteps and his own nails clawing at the ground, trying to hold himself back until they ripped from his fingers, causing a new wave of horrific sensations to burn through his body. Shom was breathing heavily. Though still daytime, they were surrounded by a deepening twilight. When she stopped dragging him at last, Aris lay still. Disbelief and agony provided a temporary buffer of shock between reality and his senses. He opened his eyes and looked up at a stone ceiling. It was festooned with moss and filth, and many legged creatures crawled there. He heard rats and gutter vipers. He smelled shit through his ruined nose. Shom picked him up by the throat and stared into his eyes. The pain stole away much of his perception, concentrating everything on the raging agony at his core. She reached her free hand to the small of her back and produced a small dagger, its blade so sharp that it felt like nothing more than a whisper on his skin as she slit his throat. Aris gasped for air, eyes wide, the stink of his own blood filling his nostrils. Before she let him go, he saw something in Shom's face that broke through the incredulity and pain. He saw pity. Then she released him, and he dropped. Light receded above and away from him, a pale circle marred only by Shom's face watching him fall. He struck water as cold as ice, so cold that it numbed his pain but not his terror. The water swept him away into a darkness so profound it had weight and texture. But another darkness crept in at the edges of his eyes, and his thoughts began to float away from him. Aris, Prince of Quandis, unmanned and cast down, pumped his blood out into the waters beneath the city, and was gone. Mouse watched him bathe. Before, Deimos had often bathed in front of Bajuman, unabashed and unashamed at his nakedness, because he'd hardly even acknowledged their presence, and if he had, then their gaze had meant nothing. Many times he and Mirren had made love while Bajuman's slaves were still in their rooms, tidying away clothes or feeding the fire. It meant nothing. They meant nothing. It was no different from washing or fucking in front of a dog. Now, Mouse stood in the room and ensured that he cleaned himself properly,
and he was aware of little else. Still, he took in the bathing room, wondering if there was anything he could use. But there wasn't much. It was a dank, echoing chamber, windowless and lit only with several oil lamps and recesses in the walls. The water was cold and slimy, cloudy from previous use. The soap pot was slick with oil and lined with hairs. It was a grim scene that seemed to echo in his mind, and perhaps Mouse was also there to ensure he didn't slip under the water and stay there. "Wash your balls," she said. Deimos scooped soap and raised himself from the bath, smearing the cool, oily mix across his genitals. He washed and submerged again, and he wasn't sure whether the whisper he heard was water splashing against stone or the Bajuman's soft laughter. He paused and looked down into the water, letting it settle so that he could see reflections in the scummy surface. The lamps cast rainbow splashes across the oily water, and he saw Mouse's inverted shadow motionless in the corner, watching. In another world, the world reflected in the bath, perhaps, she would be waiting to do his bidding. In this world, everything had changed. He closed his eyes and remembered his father's cruel death, before blood-hungry crowds, and with false allegations ringing in his ears. "Out," Mouse snapped. Deimos flinched, expecting another punch, but for now she seemed to have ended her physical abuse. "I should have fought back," he thought. "I should never allow a slave to treat me like this." But he had fought back, from the moment the guards had first seized his family to the moment Mouse had entered his cell, and every time he'd been beaten down. The brand still ached on the back of his right hand, marking his defeat, declaring his shame, announcing that he was worthless like any other slave. He knew he ought to keep fighting. His spirit raged inside, but weakened by days of incarceration, hunger, thirst, and constant beatings, he knew how it would end. If Mirin could not free him, he would have to escape, and if he hoped to escape, he would need to bide his time. He had to be careful. In his time, Deimos had seen slaves come and go from his own family's grand home, and he'd rarely considered why the new faces were there, nor where the old ones had gone. The Calistrates were not a cruel family, but he knew that life among slaves was cheap. People treated like nothing often resorted to treating each other like nothing, too. Mouse could just as soon kill him as look at him. He feared that their shared history made this likely. He climbed from the sunken bath and wiped his hands across his body, flicking away the slick remnants of oily soap. Mouse threw a tunic at him and he caught it, slipping it over his shoulders. It was itchy and rough, but it protected him from the cool breeze breathing through these subterranean chambers. He still wasn't sure where he was, nor which family had dared purchase a former noble to add to their retinue of slaves, which family could sink so low as to burn the slave's brand in the flesh of one of their own. He could have queried Mouse about the identity of his new mistress, but he feared that such a question would not be welcome, and he was intrigued enough not to wish to endanger this meeting. "Follow me," Mouse said. She turned and left the slaves' bathing rooms. In the hallway outside, there waited a man and a woman. They were dressed in tunics identical to his own, and they barely met his gaze. They carried Hessian sacks on their shoulders, and Deimos recognized them as the pale gray bags used to restore recently harvested, unground spiza. The man was Bajuman, and the woman was one of the races brought to Quandus as slaves from some faraway land. Deimos didn't even know the name of her people. He felt a spark of shame at that, and when they glanced at each other, it was he who averted his eyes. Mouse ignored the two and led him up a curved stone staircase into a wide, better-lit room. There were still no windows, but oil lamps and steel baskets hung around the walls and sat in low braziers spaced regularly around the large space. There was no ornamentation here, no nods to aesthetics. It was a purely functional room. The sudden expanse came as a shock to Deimos' senses, after days incarcerated in cells, though, and he'd let out a surprised grunt that echoed around the hall. Several slaves glanced up at the noise, then down again at what they were doing. Mouse glared at him. Four fire pits were being tended, each by two slaves. The pits were sunk into the stone floor and filled with burning hardwood and chunks of coal. That in itself was an indication as to the standing of his new master. Coal was an expensive import into Quandis, usually used by one of the five great clans, and even then most often in the homes of the barons. Only four barons now, he thought. At least until a new Calistrate baron is named. The clan members were probably already squabbling among themselves to choose a new leader. Perhaps they'd already chosen one. It disgusted Deimos to think about which cousin had presumed to take on the mantle of Calistrate leadership. He wondered if they would try to revitalize the remains of his father's estate on the hill at the northern edge of Lartha. It was painful to think of, almost as painful as memories of his father's death and his mother's and brother's beatings. He tried to cast it from his mind, but he could not help remembering their great, ancient manse ablaze, and the rest of their hilltop estate being fought over by lesser relatives eager to climb Lartha's social hierarchy. The idea was unbearable. "Move on," Mouse said, slapping him across the cheek. "Pay attention." Deimos glanced up, and her chilling eyes reflected the oil lamps like white fire. They crossed the room, passing close to one of the pits. Deimos had already smelled Spiza on the air. Now he saw why. While one slave tended the fire, the other used a hand grinder to turn dried Spiza into a fine powder. They then scattered it into the flames, and the carefully managed fires sparkled and emitted a blur of heat haze filled with Spiza fumes. Almost completely smokeless, the haze was captured by circular metal hoods hung suspended above the fire pits, and from these hoods rose narrow pipes that disappeared into the stone ceiling. Deimos could imagine heat from the fires driving the fumes up through the floors and along a network of pipes and ducts. He suspected that there were grills throughout this building, perhaps subtly hidden behind furniture or in dark corners, and that the whole place had a constant level of Spiza in its atmosphere. It was intriguing, because he also recognized the Spiza being burned. It was a calmer, used to settle nerves, relax the body, ease worries from the brain. Not the kind of mind muddler that had become almost taboo in Larthan society. Whichever noble had bought him liked to spend time in his own home, relaxed, but still keep his wits about him. The slaves worked with smooth efficiency, their pupils deep, dark holes, their mouths slack. Some of them drooled. He held his breath as they walked by. Mouse led him across the room and through an archway. They moved along a hallway, passing several closed doors on either side, until they reached the door set in the hallway's end wall. Beyond the door was another circular staircase, and this time he counted 19 worn steps until they emerged into a small, plain room. Mouse headed left, but just before following her, Deimos glanced right. A heavy wooden door had been left ajar, and through it he saw the interior of a dwelling, the likes of which he'd never seen before. The room appeared vast, with high arched ceilings and elaborate carved columns at regular intervals. Between these columns, where the ceiling curved up to its highest point, colorfully glazed roof lights let in splashes of brilliant sunlight, casting patterns down across the stone floor. It was the first daylight he'd seen in several days, and he had the strangest feeling that he was viewing the light of a different world. Things had changed,
Events had moved on, and Deimos and his family now had no influence over the land that this son continued to bathe. It was a depressing thought, and he vowed to cast it aside. If only it was that easy. They moved on. At a lower level in the huge room, curtains hung suspended between columns on invisible lines. They were beautiful, elaborate pieces of material, each of them from a different place of origin, each displaying artwork, decorative techniques, and histories from lands near and far. He recognized scenes of snow and ice from Tan Kushir's troubled history, the angular blue shading of Hirio artwork, character studies of shaman and mythical demons from Zena Pan, and the mystical ever-changing colors of a Pen Perleni tapestry. Each curtain represented a piece of high art, and he was stunned by the opulence and riches so casually on display. Not the Hartshorn clan, then, this house. The Hartshorns were never this ostentatious. He tried to narrow it down in his mind. "This way," Mouse said, but she kept her voice low, and by that he knew that they were almost there. She stood before a door in the small room's far wall. She waited until he joined her, then glanced sidelong at him. He saw a flicker of something in her eyes. Memory, perhaps even sorrow. Then she grew hard and distant once more. Mouse pushed the door open and signaled for him to enter. The Praegis's room was windowless but well-appointed, but as Mouse had told him, the Praegis was not present. And the woman who sat waiting inside was the last person Deimos expected to see. Euphraxia, apex of Quandis, voice of the Four, offered him a humorless smile. "Calistrate," she said, the word dripping from her mouth like poison. He'd never heard one word, one name imbued with such venom. And such hatred. Calistrate. The Apex hated him. The Apex hates me? Deimos had seen her many times when she conducted worship in the Foursquare, that vast expanse of rooftop contained within the boundary of the massive spires rising from the Temple of Four. Only nobility attended services in that place. And the Apex regularly preached to several hundred people, while the shadows of the spires held them in their cool embrace. To him, she had always seemed an intimidating woman, both grand and severe, and her age only exaggerated those attributes. With her sitting before him now, he felt humbled in her presence. Yet the hatred emanating from her, he couldn't parse it. "Your Holiness," Deimos began, and Mouse slammed him across the side of the head with a tight fist. He stumbled sideways into the open door and almost slid to the ground, his vision blurred, eyes watered. When he could see again, Euphraxia had not moved. She stared at him, expressionless. "Do not speak unless spoken to," Mouse hissed into his ear. She tugged at his arm and he stood, leaning against the door to maintain his balance. "I am Deimos Calistrate." He breathed deeply. He could barely believe that the Apex of the Faith could allow slaves in her household to be treated like this. But then he would not have believed that such wealth would be evident here, nor that she would exist in private in a constant state of subtle intoxication from the calming Spiza. It seemed that behind closed doors, even the greatest in the land harbored secrets. Euphraxia said nothing else to him. She merely stared, seated, while Deimos and Mouse stood just inside the open doorway. Deimos risked looking around. Euphraxia sat on a wooden bench beside a square table, upon which were piled many cooking and eating utensils and vessels. There was no food evident. The rest of the room was neat and well kept, and he imagined the Praegis lounging on his bed while a slave swept and polished around him. He could hear the Apex's heavy breathing. She was very old, yet she sat stiff and upright, proud. Maybe it was her age that necessitated the constant miasma of calming Spiza throughout her home.
"I summoned you here so that I could see your face,"
Euphraxia said at last.
"So I could study the eyes of a Calistrate brought low and see that brand on your flesh."
Deimos flinched at the disgust in her voice, and shame flooded through him. The brand. The goddamned brand. Was that all it took to turn the highest of the high into the lowest of the low? It seemed so. "That's why I'm here? You have some vendetta against my clan?" Mouse struck him again so hard that his vision blurred and fresh blood ran from his split lips. "Do not speak, you fool, and lower your damned eyes." Deimos spat blood onto the floor and glared at Mouse. He would not let them erase who he'd been, brand or no brand. "The Apex wanted to study my eyes. Perhaps you should listen more closely to your mistresses." Mouse hit him again and again, driving him to his knees with punishing blows until Euphraxia herself barked, "Enough!" Deimos kept his head down. Not that he had much choice. He could barely lift it. His blood dripped to the floor, but he felt a smirk form on his broken lips. To hell with both of them. Perhaps in his life he had earned Mouse's ire. Perhaps he had this coming from her. But he owed the Apex nothing. Euphraxia approached him. Deimos only stared at her feet, at the elegance of her boots, the dyed leather, the symbols of the four etched there.
"You're wondering why I hate you," Euphraxia rasped. "You're wondering why I bought you, why I brought you here. What will become of you? Well, you should know that I will enjoy having you here, in the bowels of my house, toiling and bleeding and seething in fury every moment. You cannot fall from such heights and live in such misery without praying for answers. And what better place to pray than the House of the Apex? Your prayers will be wasted, of course. I brought you here to tell you nothing. I know that the mystery of it will only add to your suffering, as you wonder why for the rest of your wretched, painful life."
The Apex spat upon him. He watched her feet as she turned away in dismissal.
"Take him out of here," she sneered. "But harm him no further. He is the lowest of my slaves, but still a slave in the household of the Apex. I want his life to be insufferably long, full of days of drudgery and nights of indignity. The slaves are to treat him as if he were their own slave."
Her boots clicked on the floor as she walked away, and a distant door opened and closed.
"What of my mother?" he wondered. "What of my brother Cyrus? How did this happen?"
Deimos dreaded the answers. He looked up at Mouse, expecting triumphant disdain. But instead he saw sympathy there and had no idea what to feel. "Time to start work, slave," she said. Averting his eyes, Deimos stood and walked from the room. Once Mouse started leading him into the cellars, though, he glared at the back of her head.
"I am no one's slave," he thought, vowing to keep hold of such defiance.
It would probably be the only fire he had to keep him warm.
Chapter 6. Phyla's skin felt flushed, though she could not see her own hands in the darkness inside the walls. A ghost of herself, invisible to all, even her own eyes, she nevertheless felt more alive than ever before. What was this feeling, this tremor in her heart, this prickling at the back of her neck. She had been in danger before, but she thought this must be what true peril felt like. Yet at the same time, she'd never felt in more control. The whole world seemed soft and yielding, and it was her touch that might keep it propped up or bring it tumbling down. Aris had never had the patience even to play cards, never mind to build little houses out of them. But Fila had played that game with her sister when they were small girls, and Mirren had been the master of it. She had the patience and dexterity to not even breathe, for fear an errant exhalation might bring the entire house of cards down. Fila had not realized then how much she had learned from watching Mirren work with those cards and helping her set them in place. But learn she had. The crown was as fragile as the structures she and Mirren had built. According to legend and faith, the royal family had the blood of the four in their veins, and the people needed to believe that for the crown to remain strong. Fila needed to believe it herself, not only to believe it, but to confirm it. Her family had become a house of cards. The entire kingdom rested atop it. Fila had spent years whispering behind the walls, studying what history she could find, learning all she could about her family. She knew that the trick now would be to dismantle the house while leaving the kingdom itself unharmed. If she could do that, then she could rebuild the crown into the shape she desired using far sturdier materials. Namely, myself. Behind the walls, she listened as the slow collapse of her mother's house began to gain speed.
"Speak the truth to me now, Commander," Queen Lysandra said. Her raspy voice edged with warning. "I know the five clans are rife with treachery and treason, and I must know who among them are my enemies."
"Majesty, I always speak the truth to you," Commander Curtness replied.
The wariness in his voice would be plain to anyone who had not lost the ability to gauge the behavior of those around them.
"Members of the City Guard have spent the past 2 days out among the five clans. In uniform, they have searched every room of every noble household, and out of uniform, they have gone quietly onto the hills and into the streets, and listened to the mutterings of nobles and rabble alike. We found no evidence of a significant uprising. What we've found more than anything is fear. The execution of Linos Calistrate and the enslavement of—"
"Liar!"
screamed the queen. Fila flinched. Even with long years of practice remaining still while whispering, the pain and panic in her mother's ragged voice startled her. She could only imagine what it had done to those in the room with her. In addition to Curtness, Shom was there, of course. But who else? Fila had only started listening a moment before, and now this.
"Majesty,"
Curtness murmured.
"Don't try to mollify me!"
Queen Lysandra screamed again, and then her voice dropped low as if she spoke only to herself.
"I have been ill, Commander. But don't confuse illness with weakness. My beauty may be ruined, but I have all the cunning I've ever had."
"My queen," said another, and Fila recognized the voice, Daphna. "You have always relied on Commander Curtness's guidance and loyalty. If he says—" The queen actually hissed.
"Don't speak to me as if we were friends, Daphna. I put words in your mouth and you speak them. Those are the only words I want to hear from you, the ones that echo my own. You have no opinion. Now shut up!"
A moment passed in awkward silence. Fila could imagine them all wondering what to do next, wondering just how mad the queen had become. Then she heard a loud sniff, and she could smell the sharp odor of burning spiza, and she knew that her mother must be indulging. Throughout her life, Fila had learned many things about her mother while whispering, and until she had seen the queen taking spiza with Linos Calistrate, she'd thought there had been nothing left that might shock or disappoint her. But this,
in front of others. Her nostrils flared in revulsion. Fila felt sick as she waited for one of the queen's advisors to speak up in objection, or at least to question the wisdom of partaking at this time. No objection came, though. Instead, the next voice surprised her. It belonged to a man of whose presence she had been entirely unaware, and that unsettled her. "The city guard are not the only ones who move among the people," the man said. It took a moment for Fila to place him. She recalled a long, black braided beard and a scarred face, a shaved head, the air of a soldier never quite comfortable with his role of priest, though he had changed the path of his life from the worship of war to the worship of the 4 decades earlier. Per Ostvik was one of the High Order. Fila frowned. If Ostvik was here, where was Euphraxia? The High Order were a clan unto themselves, fiercely secretive and protective of their own ranks. But surely Euphraxia, the Apex, would not approve of her subordinates meeting with the queen without her present. "All right, priest," the queen said, her voice dripping with uncommon disdain. "Tell me what you holy ones have learned." Where had that disrespect come from? Fila had believed her mother intimate with the Apex and the High Order. In seeking magic, surely Queen Lysandra had conspired with them to break the laws of both faith and crown. Nothing about this meeting made sense to Fila, and more than anything, that bothered her. The cards teetered. "Majesty," Per Ostvik said warily, "you must trust someone. If you cannot trust those who speak for the gods, who else remains?" Fila heard her mother whimper then, and she knew the House of Cards must truly be at its end. The last few walls were falling, or else Lysandra would never have shown such weakness to anyone. "You have been my friend, Ostvik," the queen said. "But I've put too much faith in you already. If you tell me there is no conspiracy..."
"Quite the contrary, Majesty,"
the priest said, his voice ringing loudly. Even from the other side of the wall, Fila could feel his voice inside her chest. There was a deep power there. "There are conspirators all around, but most of those voices are easily silenced. Clan Daklun fears for their foreign trade and the safety of their merchant ships abroad. But they will be loyal if they believe the crown can keep the economy stable. The same is true of Clan Elster, who care only about the product of their farms and mills, and Clan Burnwell, who give their loyalty always to strength, to command. I worry more about Clan Hartshorn."
"Poets and teachers,"
Commander Curtness sniffed dismissively.
"We're to fear them."
Fila could almost see the way Per Ostvik would be narrowing his eyes now, angry at the interruption. "Artists," Per Ostvik said.
"Historians. You dismiss them so easily. The women and men of Clan Hartshorn are, and always have been, the most suspicious of the crown. But there's a reason they're a great clan. Because knowledge is power. Words and influence are power. As much, if not more, than the swords your soldiers hold. Trust me when I tell you rebellion is there, simmering quietly in the cellars and alleys of that hill, behind the stained glass windows and beneath the lyrics of each new song being sung there today."
"My queen," Daphne said, "I believe it would be an error to make rash generalizations about..."
"But of course you know the real problem,"
Per Ostvik cut in. No one said a word. Stuck between the walls, Fila exhaled, and a small cloud of dust danced away from her lips. Her ear remained pressed to the wood, and her feet ached with the cold of the stone beneath them. She felt the solidity of wood and stone as if they were her own limbs, and the entire palace was her flesh and blood. But to those within the queen's chambers, she remained a phantom. Even in their silence, they would never hear. Except, perhaps, Shom.
but the captain of the Silent would not speak against her.
"Clan Callistrate," the queen said at last, revealing that despite her paranoia and failing health, she had not completely lost her senses. "Killing their baron has left a void."
"Callistrate Hill is in disarray," Commander Curtness began.
"Chaos, you mean?" Per Ostvik said.
"It isn't merely the